Hi, this is Jeff Rittner, and you are listening to Rittner Reflections, a forum for exploring the dynamic, complex, and essential nature of cross-border trade, and a space to reflect on the deeper questions that shape how we live, lead, and move through uncertainty. You know, today, speaking of uncertainty, we are living through a moment like no other. Geopolitics have moved from the supporting cast to the main actor, shaping how companies operate, invest, and compete in real time. National security, economic statecraft, and technology leadership are converging, and companies are being pulled into the center of that collision, whether they're ready or not. And that is why this conversation is so important right now. And I wanted Jeanette in this chair. Jeanette Chu and I have been operating in this world from very different angles. She, as a diplomat, law enforcement veteran, consultant, U.S.-China relations specialist at a leading think tank, and now one of Washington's sharpest national security trade strategists. And me, I've spent years inside a global semiconductor company navigating these pressures firsthand. Jeanette introduced me recently to a concept that reframed how I think about all of it. Geostrategy, connecting geopolitical reality to corporate decision-making in a more intentional, forward-looking way. In this two-part series of episode 31, we explore this from both ends, the strategic landscape and the operational reality of how companies execute. Welcome, Jeanette. Thank you for joining me. Today is June 10th, and we are sitting in a podcast room just outside your office here in Washington, D.C. I am so excited to spend this time with you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I'm delighted to see you back here in Washington.
Before we dive in, I wanted to just ground our listeners in your background and why your voice is so essential right now. You've led national security and competitiveness work at NFTC, founded the Alliance for National Security and Competitiveness. You serve as a non-resident senior associate at CSIS, and you previously spent a decade as a senior U.S. diplomat in China. You've also guided multinational companies through some of the most complex compliance and enforcement challenges in the system. Now, you and I have been in conversation about these issues for years. And in one of our recent discussions, you introduced a concept that really stuck with me, geostrategy. And it really felt like this is the right moment to explore this a lot more deeply. So let's start right there. When you talk about geostrategy, what do you mean? And why is this the right moment for companies to adopt that mindset?
Well, Jeff, again, thank you so much for having me on Rittner's Reflections. It's an honor and pleasure to be picking up our conversation, actually, as our thinking about all of this continues to evolve. So you mentioned in your introduction, geopolitics, that is still very much front and center. CEOs that never have thought about this now are standing up geopolitical risk departments in their companies to be able to manage and monitor all of the developments happening around the world. National security, as you mentioned, geoeconomics, economic security, economic statecraft, and now, in this moment, we've arrived at geostrategy. So in the first two, geopolitics is something that is external. It happens, and then we all scramble to respond, right? When we move from national security to economic security, again, something happens, markets respond, companies may have to pivot. I think the pandemic was a huge lesson for many of us, particularly those of us that work in supply chain, logistics, trade, right? How very important it is to be able to meet that moment. And increasingly, economic security and national security have become intertwined.
Right.
They don't quite converge, but they definitely intertwine. sometimes into accordion knot. Geostrategy, in my mind, is almost an inflection point. It's how companies think strategically, act proactively, and neutralize surprises. Stability, predictability is so important to business operations. Nobody makes a CapEx decision in the morning and has it done by noon.
Right.
Same. You don't unwind that immediately. That's why geopolitics has such an outsized influence. Look at all of the world events that have happened so far this year. Huge impact on business. Geostrategy is a way to think about this that harnesses all of that, right? It harnesses the fact that this morning's opportunity becomes an almost insurmountable challenge before you have finished your coffee. So how do we harness the sensory overload of information that is always changing, sometimes conflicts, and isn't always reliable, and build that stability, bake in resilience? How do we ensure durability? I hear companies talk a lot about being nimble, responding. Geostrategy reframes that because it's about leaning into headwinds and emerging stronger. You define the four corners of the box.
I'm just drinking my coffee and I wonder what's changed today. I love the way you've described that, Jeanette. And what really resonated with me is I lived through a moment that you mentioned, the pandemic, where as a company, we were absolutely caught off guard. No one planned. And it was quite a moment of trying to figure out how do you adjust and how do you make sure the business is not impacted. I also went through the same sort of thing when Russia invaded Ukraine, and just the sudden, you know, change to our business. And I think the struggle I always had is some of these things happen so unexpectedly. So how do companies, how do they take that strategy mindset? How do they really prepare? Are there certain BKMs that you're aware of that would help companies do that?
I think I used to say that I had a murky marble, and then somehow it did not make it into my shipment back from China. At this moment, I think we're all looking for that same murky marble, right? We're all scrambling after something that we can fix on. Information should inform. It should not necessarily drive, right?
Right.
It is very important to look at data, to understand the data. Mm-hmm. It is also equally important to know to ask the right questions. Companies that succeed are always pressure testing their assumptions. And that's something that I see as not so much a defensive measure, mm-hmm. but it helps you get ahead of that game. You asked what makes you better at this and right. not being caught off guard. And I think it is that constant, what should I be thinking about? What am I not seeing? What is my out plan?
Yeah, that's helpful. I recall back in my days at Intel, we had a team of people that spent time once a year categorizing major risks. And with the idea of, in my role was trade, so in these particular risks, what were the trade implications? And so we had a method to try to keep ahead, but there's always things. And today, in our world today, I don't know how, as you said, how you keep track with how quickly things are changing, but it is a challenge for companies. And I think having already a framework and understanding this concept that, you know, I can't just, like you said, just react to everything that happens, but I have to have a strategic lens and looking at how to anticipate. Makes a lot of sense.
Sometimes I think about this and I challenge companies on this. How do they separate static out of everything that they hear, right?
Yeah.
That's what strategy is. Noise minus static is your strategy.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that makes so much sense because I know how easy it is to react to everything. And if you have a good strategy, you're less likely to have to react. Because you rely on that.
So, Jeff, I'm wondering, in these meetings, these big risk meetings that you had once a year, it wouldn't shock me, by the way, if that is now done quarterly.
Yes.
Was there ever a Monday morning quarterback or hot wash where you looked at that and said, this one we nailed, this one no one saw coming, we didn't have that on our bingo card or whatever? Did you ever do any kind of an after-action analysis?
Yeah, I think with the pandemic, I don't recall that. With the Russia situation, yes, because it had huge implications. I think one of the things that I really appreciated with the process was it was an annual process. And every year you had a heat map that you had to document where you were on the risk scale. And what I really appreciated is over the years, we could see movement, right? And so one of the things from a trade perspective is we oftentimes had our business in China as a risk. So high likelihood that there could be something, you know, that would impact our business. And the impact was huge, right? So you had that lens of what's the impact, you know, and it was high. And then what's the likelihood? In some situations, it was low likelihood. But in today's world, that likelihood thing was moving a lot. And so what I appreciated was having the ability to look over several years and see where that was moving. And I remember in the whole China thing, I saw that little X in the box move up to what I would call the corner, the right corner, where you had the intersection of high impact, high likelihood. Right. And so that was, for me, that was a way of monitoring how is this changing and what are we doing about it. And so I think we did have that ongoing process that helped. But going back and actually taking each situation and diving into it, I don't recall that necessarily.
Fascinating. Thanks for sharing that.
Jeanette, let's shift slightly, because one of the things I appreciate about your background is just the focus on national security and as a competitiveness issue. And I'm really kind of curious, how has the national security landscape really expanded over the last few years?
So traditionally, national security has been about military force projection and everything that goes into that. Mm-hmm. Deployment, personnel, material, weapon systems, protecting the homeland, safe. And then it grows, right? Then it's about safeguarding critical assets, things like infrastructure, the grid, water resources. Those will become the battlefields of the future. We're talking now about space, right? So national security, the expansion of national security is about harnessing forward technologies, a term that I coined to capture foundational, critical, and frontier technologies that shape offensive and defensive capabilities. More than just rushing up against national security, it's shaping what that means. Sometimes people will say, well, if everything's national security, then nothing's national security. Fair criticism, but I think, again, it's about reframing that lens so that you're not reacting to, oh, well, they just say everything's national security, so it gets focused, but more thinking strategically about how does this impact national security? And so companies are affected more and more today than ever before. Economic tradecraft, lawfare, if you want to call it that, means that nation states use the tools at their disposal in order to gain that leverage, and often do so by invoking national security interests. We've watched China do this over the past 2 years, even last week, very, very aggressively, right? With the most recent State Council decree around outbound investment. And we see what we've done here in the United States as well. So increasingly, these economic security tools are part of the national security, right? Mm-hmm. How do we use trade tools to gain or preserve strategic national security advantages?
One of the tools that I have lived and breathed for decades is export controls. And you and I have talked a lot about export controls. In fact, I think I first met you over export controls, right? Back in China. Yeah. But how do you see export controls shaping this sort of national security? You just mentioned China, and China has also adopted export controls and the U.S. So how do you see that?
I think export controls are always an implement of national security. Mm-hmm. That doesn't preclude them from being used for other purposes, as we've seen in this administration, to gain leverage, to get people to the table. Section 232 tariffs, for example, are the result of an investigation into the national security implications of certain sectoral imports. A national security tool that has caught attention, made other governments come forward and say, hey, we want to talk to you. And it's been used quite successfully to develop new alliances. You can talk about the bilateral agreements on reciprocal trade or ARTS. You can talk about the plurilateral coalitions that they are still standing up, whether that's Pax Silica, the critical minerals ministerial, all of that stuff. So all of these things shape global markets. And now export controls, what former Undersecretary Eric Horsham once said, I'll never forget this, it was at an update conference. He said, export controls, the skunk at the picnic. Now we're front and center, right? I mean, this used to be a backwater.
Yes.
No one even knew what it was. Suddenly, everyone is thinking about what are the implications. How does export controls sometimes converge with sanctions or overlap with sanctions or the role that it plays in foreign investment security and other forums?
I've always worked in the export control area, and you're right. It was something that was a necessary evil, if you will. You had to make sure you had the right authorizations and so on. But today it's critical. But I think one of the things I struggle with is what I've always seen was export controls were a multilateral effort. You had agreements within the Wassenaar countries to agree on what should be controlled and not. And that seems to have gone by the wayside. And so I'm just curious your perspective on, are we moving away from multilateralism and now it's just a plurilateral approach, or how do you see that playing out?
Well, we still have the Missile Technology Control Regime. We still have the Australia Group, nuclear suppliers. All is not lost. I share your concern about Wassenaar for sure. And particularly since the U.S. has had such a leadership role. And because Wassenaar controls both munitions list items and dual use items, the scope is so vast. I think, though, when I'm at my most pessimistic, I say that we have grown apart from like a bipolar world, right? Mm-hmm. Or a world with like, there's the U.S. and then there's kind of a Eastern Bloc or whatever. And that the new world order is what you described, Jeff, that bits and pieces of plurilateral alliances. I would add that these plurilateral alliances are alliances of convenience or around a specific issue, and they are non-exclusive. I used to say non-monogamous, but people would look at me quite oddly. There's room in this world for both. I don't see any move to dissolve Wassenaar or any of the other alliances.
Right.
But increasingly, because of what we, other countries, not just China, the EU, others as well, are doing with their own export control laws and mechanisms and exploring the fringes, the frontiers of extraterritorial application, you cannot get away from that plurilateral aspect.
Right. I think that has become critical, and especially in certain technologies. Think about semiconductors. I mean, that's where I came from, the semiconductor world. But it's, we've seen, you know, export controls be front and center when it comes to semiconductors. Do you believe that the export controls for, on the whole, semiconductor industry is effective? Is it the right way to go? I mean, there's been talk about by putting export controls in place, you're going to prevent China from advancing. Others have said, well, by putting export controls and restricting them from getting products, you're actually accelerating their innovation. So how do you see that point?
You can hold two thoughts in your head at the same time.
Right.
Both of those have more than a grain of truth, for sure. I spoke at CSIS. I was on a panel about a month, maybe a month or two ago, where BIS had just announced a huge enforcement action on chips. And I said, many people are pointing to that as a failure of semiconductor export control. No, that is an export enforcement success. That demonstrates the success of BIS's Office of Export Enforcement and its small but mighty cadre of special agents. So be very clear about that distinction. Just because something is detected, stopped, prosecuted, does not mean that the control itself failed.
So I'd like to kind of shift, if I could, to China, because you spent more than a decade in China as a diplomat. And from your vantage point, what do companies still misunderstand about China's strategic objectives? And how does that affect their operating environment?
Jeff, actually, I think companies have come a long way, and companies get it right more often than not. I worry more about whether or not governments get it right. I think because companies are on the ground and have been for a very long time, they're pretty clear-eyed about what China's strategic objectives are. What they may not be quite as clear-eyed about is their ability to, again, be pacing, to stay ahead of that. for underestimating China's ability to not just copy, if you will, but to take and synthesize what we talk about this now in the AI context as distillation, right?
Right.
And so I think, if anything, companies might be underestimating a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Less and less and less and less, and less so in the technology space would be my caveat. Every company I talk to that has a significant China presence is very realistic and also very much aware and appreciative of the deep talent pool and the resources and the resolve of the government,
right,
both publicly and also in terms of the investments made domestically for its strategic objectives.
We've seen over the last couple of years, China implement their own export control program. And I remember over the years having done business with China, I always wondered when that day was coming because they never used to have them. And maybe they had a small rule somewhere, but there wasn't much. You lived in China, you worked there. What's going on in their minds when they think about export controls? What exactly are they trying to achieve through their programs?
I remember when they first started thinking about it.
Yes.
It was actually circa maybe about 2006. At that time, the Ministry of Commerce and BIS jointly administered end-use visits. So as the export control officer, I would go with a Ministry of Commerce official who had made the arrangements for us to be able to access a fab, for example, right? And so we're coming home from a bunch of foundry visits in Shanghai to Beijing. We're on the plane, and he turns to me, and this was someone who had been a diplomat in America, by the way, twice, and said to me, I think we need our own export controls, and maybe they should look like this. And he's basically parroting back to me the contours of the Export Administration Regulation. And I said, how are you going to do that? Because up until then, to your point, Jeff, you're exactly right. China's export controls were managed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
They were very narrow. They were about nuclear, because China was part of the, you know, nuclear suppliers group. And so it was really about managing proliferation of nuclear weapons more than anything else.
Right.
So this concept of dual use controls is extremely novel. What they've done very recently is not just react by having their new export control law, by implementing a anti-foreign sanctions law and now outbound investment. It's not just parroting. They are laying a foundation so that they have all this toolkit ready to roll.
Yeah.
Whether they need it or not.
I would probably, based on our conversation, I would say that maybe that represents their geo strategy.
It could be, yes. Certainly we saw that in the last year with critical minerals and processed derivatives front and center.
Right.
But you know, geography is not necessarily destiny.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it'll be interesting to see what they do next.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, the critical minerals, you know, I was working with a company and this became front and center for them. And one of the things that just rocked their world was when there was one of the announcements that was published that basically said that any critical mineral, and it was at 0.001% of China origin, would be subject to China export licenses, and trying to think about how would that actually work in reality. And I don't know, do you think that was real, or is that more of just a negotiating piece to try to come to a better, more middle ground solution?
I'm sure it was real. I'm sure there was a tremendous amount of analysis and study behind it.
Yeah.
I think the real question is, what would trigger implementing that?
But how would they implement it?
And that's where the rubber meets the road, right? I've not followed as closely the role of the General Administration of China Customs, because a customs official bore personal liability for breaking a seal on a container. So if they were wrong, even if they relied on intelligence or whatever, and they were acting in their official capacity, there could be significant personal ramification. I don't know if that's changed.
I'd really be interested to see how this will play out, because I know that the MOFCOM, which is, I think, the agency administering the licenses, they are issuing licenses. I know the company I'm with have received a few, so it is happening. But I think probably this is a journey for China to not only to codify and actually implement export controls is probably a new experience that they're going through. So, well, thank you for the thoughts on China. We could talk forever. There's so much going on there, but I want to shift over to your work with the Alliance for National Security and Competitiveness. And I'm just curious, what motivated its creation?
So the National Foreign Trade Council, NFTC, was incredibly prescient. Way back in the middle of the pandemic, they started to realize the board, our president, Jake Colvin, were some of the first people to understand and see the implications of the convergence of national security and economic security and say, hey, this is going to come and affect all of our companies. What are we going to do about this? And that's important because NFTC until then had a really important program called USA Engage, which was about making sure that the voice of business was heard with respect to unilateral sanctions. They did a complete rethink of that around the time that I always think of them as my predecessor, Richard Sawaya, who ran USA Engage, retired. And the thought was, we need to think beyond sanctions. We keep hearing about export controls, to your point, Jeff, and all these other things, and we got to get a grip. And so I was working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, co-leading the National Security Regulatory Compliance Practice at the time. PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, sits on NFTC's board, got this white paper, and said, well, the representative who I knew, the board member said, I might not know this stuff, but I know exactly who does, and got permission to share it with me. I had a conversation with Jake about their concept around this. I was very intrigued. I thought, wow, you guys are really leading the pack. It's all about that sort of setting the pace, right? And then thought nothing more. And then months went by. They had set up the program. They were looking for someone to lead national security policy and create an alliance for national security and competitiveness. So I take absolutely no credit for this. All of it goes to Jake, our executive board, our chair, Ambassador Susan Schwab, former U.S. Trade Representative, for recognizing the importance of national security. And truly, competitiveness is a critical component. You don't get national security without that competitiveness. Jeff, you worked for decades at a leading U.S. technology firm. Think about all the contributions. Where would we be? Any of us be today without Intel, and think about everything that Intel then spun in all around the world.
Right, right. Now, that's a great point. Absolutely. So as you work with companies, what themes are emerging?
Companies have integrated that thought process of national security, even if they are not directly involved in making a national security product. Yeah. Whether that's a tangible hardware item or software technology code. Companies understand that they have a seat at that national security table.
Right, right.
And it's critical that their voice is heard.
Right.
Companies understand the importance, for example, not just the BIS, but of what Export Administration does far beyond licensing, because they have to get CCATs, right? They have to get that commodity classification in addition to licenses, in addition to understanding the entity list and all the other things. And they get the broader ecosystem. They understand the importance of things like the Federal Communications Commission and many other players to the table. They are so sophisticated now in how they approach the most critical, pressing questions of our time.
To be wrap up here, just looking ahead a bit, what are the next frontiers of geostrategy in your mind?
Wow, what a terrific question. How can we think about frontier technologies? Do we get AI governance right? And when we do, does that become a good blueprint, say, for thinking about quantum? What is life in a post-silicon world? I think a lot about that because after spending the last year doing a lot of work around critical minerals and some of the shortages in yttrium and things like that, that gets solved through new materials. It gets solved through fundamental basic research, material science. Are we doing enough to not just ensure that that happens, but what are the correct accelerants to apply to those things?
There's no doubt you mentioned complexity, and I think as we look forward, that complexity remains, and I think that drives the need for geostrategy, really thinking about the future and how you're going to navigate a world that's become so complex, and everyone trying to navigate through the national security implications and all the other geopolitical ramifications that are going on. So I think the next year or two is going to be fascinating.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it.
This has been a great discussion. Is there anything else you wanted to say about geostrategy before we conclude?
Jeff, I have to say, you, so many others that we know in this trade space are really the ones that have formed the basis for this framing. And for that, I'm profoundly grateful.
Well, thank you, Jeanette. This has been an incredibly rich start to our conversation. We've laid out the strategic landscape, the forces that are reshaping how companies operate, and the realities they can't afford to ignore. In part two, we're going to shift from the big picture to the operational side. And so how do companies actually execute in this environment? So I hope you'll join us. Thank you.